Good afternoon. I'm Allison Ruttenberg, number 17497. I'm ADC appointed counsel for Mr. Gregory Bowers. Mr. Gregory Bowers was convicted of four counts of first-degree homicide, and he did appeal his sentence, and he lost the direct appeal and the mandate issued on October 16th, 1990. Admittedly, he did wait 18 years before exercising his post-conviction right, and he filed his pro se Rule 35C on June 26, 2008. So that's the critical fact here, that we've got an 18-year delay between the date of the mandate on direct appeal and the date he filed his pro se Rule 35C. The statute itself states that there's no period of limitations to file a post-conviction motion under Rule 35C for a first-class felony, such as what Mr. Bowers was convicted of. The district court dismissed this motion based on the equitable doctrine of laches, saying that he's equitably barred from pursuing post-conviction options because of the unreasonable delay in filing his Rule 35C that prejudiced the people. My position is, and I've briefed this thoroughly, is that it's not enough that there was an unreasonable delay that prejudiced the people. That in order to be barred by laches, there's an intermediary element that must be proven that seems to be getting skipped over more and more often. And that is that the side that's seeking to assert the laches doctrine not only must be prejudiced, but must show that the prejudice flows from some change in position in reliance upon the fact that the other party delayed in exercising his rights. And a district attorney cannot show that in this case.
So Ms. Ruttenberg, let's go right to that, because that argument is very clearly stated in your briefs. Other than the use of the word reliance in the I think it's Vasquez case by a division of this court, Valdez, is there any other authority that you have for that position under Colorado law in the criminal context? Because I don't see the word reliance anywhere in the Robbins case, and I don't see the word detrimental reliance anywhere in the Valdez case.
I agree that there's no criminal cases stating that. I'm borrowing from the civil cases, because if you read out the requirement for detrimental reliance, then what you have is that the court is able to get around the statute of limitations, which the legislature determines, merely by finding prejudice flowing from an unreasonable delay. And respectfully, there's always going to be prejudice from a delay, every single time. Witnesses' memories always decay. Witnesses die. Documents get lost. There is always going to be prejudice when there is any sort of delay, whether it's a civil case, a criminal case, or what have you. And if the laches doctrine is utilized in such a way that all you are requiring is prejudice flowing from the delay, then every single time the court is going to be able to rewrite a statute of limitations, not only in the criminal context, but in a civil context as well.
Why is that the case, that there will always be prejudice? Isn't that exactly why the standard of review says when you're trying to apply the legal test to a set of facts, that's at the discretion of the court, and he or she decides whether there is prejudice? I mean, it seems to me there is a demonstrable difference between filing this post-conviction relief 3.5 years or whatever after the mandate and 18 years. And why isn't that something for the court, trial court, to figure out in the first instance?
Well, in this case, what if he had filed his Rule 35C only 3.5 years later? The district attorney would be prejudiced in that case for exactly the same reasons as he's prejudiced now, because the district attorney in this case destroyed the evidence before the mandate even issued.
But you have the trial court saying, the destruction of the evidence aside, that there was plenty of prejudice to satisfy the test here, forgetting about the evidence that was destroyed.
And again, my argument is that those types of prejudice that the trial court is finding is the prejudice you would always find after 18 years, because witnesses die, witnesses' memories decay. You can't expect, after 18 years, for a witness's memory to be in the same condition as it was 18 years earlier. And if you allow just that type of finding of prejudice based on those types of items, then you always have the ability to rewrite a statute of limitations and get around a legislative decree, which the courts are not supposed to do. That's why you need that intermediate argument, which is present in all other types of equitable cases, such as equitable estoppel, promissory estoppel. You need more than prejudice. You need detrimental reliance from which the prejudice flows. Otherwise, there isn't a basis to exercise the court's equitable jurisdiction to then get around a legislative decree.
What do you do about the Robbins case, which we're bound by as an intermediate appellate court, which never mentions reliance, let alone detrimental reliance? It talks only about an unreasonable delay and prejudice flowing from that delay, and it mentions such things as witnesses dying or losing their memory. And how do you deal with that? How do we, as an appellate court, deal with the Supreme Court telling us that's what the test is?
Well, if all I can accomplish at this point is to point out that the Robbins case needs to be revisited, I respectfully submit that under the Valdez case, that this court under Valdez can find that Valdez does require detrimental reliance, and detrimental reliance has not and cannot be shown here because of the decisions of the district attorney in destroying the evidence.
Counsel, my understanding is that one of your main arguments is that the defendant was not mentally competent or was to have been found to have committed the crime. He was mentally impaired at the time he committed the crime. Is that right? That's one of your issues that the counsel didn't raise below?
That was one of the arguments below, that he had some sort of impaired mental capacity when he set fire to this house. I mean, that was...
And is there some basis for saying that there's evidence that would have established that was amongst the materials that were destroyed by the district attorney?
Well, one of the materials that were destroyed by the district attorney was the defendant's taped confession. So that's the best evidence that was available at the time of what the defendant was thinking, how he's reacting, and what he was saying. And that tape was destroyed several weeks before the mandate even issued.
What I'm not clear, though, is what is the district attorney supposed to do in a situation of impaired mental, where there's an impaired mental claim brought up 20 years later? Are they supposed to every 6 months ask to have a mental examination of the defendant to determine what the mental state of that person is? I mean, it's pretty difficult after, it's actually 27 years, I think, since the crime was committed, to say, okay, now we'll try to figure out whether this gentleman was mentally impaired 27 years ago. A lot of things can happen in 27 years. And he's apparently written a pretty good motion. Whether that goes to his mental impairment, I don't know, but recreating what happened 27 years ago is difficult. I guess what I'm saying is there's kind of a reliance that we all have in final judgments. It's inherent in the notion of a final judgment. And how do we deal with a situation like this involving mental impairment where the evidence relates to the defendant's state of mind 27 years ago as opposed to now?
Well, you always have that problem every time a defendant raises some sort of mental impairment or competency issue in a post-conviction motion, whether it's 3 years, 6 years, 10 years, or 15 years after the fact. I mean, if this had been one of the cases where the direct appellate process took 12 years, and that's not uncommon, unfortunately, and then he had filed his 35C only 3 years later, then we'd be 15 years after the trial and we'd have the same problem, but the district attorney would not be arguing latches. He'd just be arguing that the defendant cannot meet his burden of proof because all his experts can do 15 years after the fact is speculate, and then that kind of puts a cart before the horse, and you can't even make that determination until you have an evidentiary hearing given a defendant the opportunity to even try to present that through his experts that was even denied at this point. But if you're going to say that the district attorney will always have these types of problems 18, 20, 25 years later after the fact with certain types of issues that can be raised in a 35C motion, then what the court respectfully is trying to do is completely rewrite a Colorado statute. I mean, the legislature was very clear in the statute that there is no time limit for filing a Rule 35C in a homicide case or in any first-class felony case. And if the court says, well, all you have to show is prejudice flowing from a delay, no matter how unreasonable or not, then there is never going to be a case. I can't even think of a case where you're going to be able to litigate a 35C in a first-class felony case 10, 15, 20 years after the mandate issues, after a direct appeal. And you might even be able to make the same arguments if in the case where just because the appellate process took so long, now the district attorney is prejudiced in being able to defend against a 35C. And even if a defendant files a 35C within weeks or months after the mandate issues, if the direct appellate process took 12 or 15 years, then the district attorney is going to be able to spring-load this laches argument and say, well, you're still barred by laches. You let the direct appeal process drag on and on and on for years when you knew you had this competency issue you wanted to raise in a 35C. You should have filed for a limited remand from the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, wherever your case was stuck at for all these years, and asked to litigate this issue because now we're prejudiced. This will just open up this giant floodgate to where the district attorney is being able to really truncate the post-conviction rights in violation of the legislative mandate that there is no statute of limitations.
I guess what I keep struggling with, first of all, we don't have those facts here, and that might very well change an outcome, but hasn't that ship sailed? I mean, is Robin specifically held in a first-degree murder case? There is the possibility of having laches, and these are the elements that a court should look at, and I'm struggling with the role of what our court is, given the fact that the guys upstairs have already made a ruling on that.
Well, I think that the Supreme Court was trying to follow these other precedents from the Supreme Court that dealt with laches, and those other precedents that I discussed in my reply brief are much more clear. And there may be some sloppy wording in Robbins, but I think the intent is that this be an equitable defense. And if it's an equitable defense, then we must have detrimental reliance. Otherwise, you're just rewriting the statute of limitations. And that was pretty clear, I think, in the way this court selected the wording in Valdez, talking about detrimental reliance.
How do we know the sloppy wording isn't in Valdez instead of Robbins?
Because of all these other equitable cases where...
All of which are civil.
But counsel, the cases that are cited in Valdez do not cite to reliance. There are a number of cases from the Supreme Court, I agree, that talk about the reliance element. Many of them, frankly, come up in the water context, but they do come up. But none of the cases that I read cited in Robbins talk about reliance.
Well...
It would suggest to me that they are drawing a distinction between some civil cases where they have called for reliance and criminal cases where they're not requiring reliance.
Since the doctrine of laches itself is a civil concept that the court was borrowing from a criminal case, I can't accept that argument that there's going to be two completely different standards. And in a criminal case, you don't have to show detrimental reliance, because then we get back to the same problem of the courts rewriting the General Assembly's law, where the General Assembly was very clear that there is no statute of limitations here. And all of these arguments about prejudice are the types of considerations in a statute of limitations. That's the type of issue that the statute of limitations is intended to address, and the General Assembly chose not to have a statute of limitations in a first-class felony case. So, I guess I just have a few seconds here. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve. Thank you.
That's fine. Thank you, Ms. Ruttenberg. You've got about a half a minute when you come back.
May it please the court. My name is Melissa Allen. I'm here on behalf of the people. It is the people's position that it's exactly the case that in the criminal context, I believe that Robbins and Valdez demonstrate that the people are not required to show detrimental reliance. I think there's a reason for that. In the criminal context, it would be virtually impossible to show some kind of contractual or civil detrimental reliance by the DA relying on something that the defense has done. Because in a case exactly like this, the defense has done nothing for 18 years. So it's impossible to show detrimental reliance. You have to rely on the prejudice for that third prong. And I would dispute that we're just talking about prejudice here. It's not just prejudice in order to have a court make a finding that latches bars a post-conviction motion after a period of time. You have to show an unconscionable delay in the defendant's enforcement of his rights. It's not just the delay. There has to be a lack of diligence in the face of actual knowledge giving rise to the claim. And then the prejudice prong. And Valdez does, you know, when it lists the civil test, it does say in the opinion, one, full knowledge of the facts, two, unreasonable delay, and then three, intervening reliance by and prejudice to another. But that's the only reference to reliance. It goes on to discuss the facts of that case, just as Robbins did. And in both opinions, the only thing in that third prong that either court focuses on is the prejudice resulting from the delay. And I think it's very similar to what we have here, taking the whole record out of the equation. I think the court made the same finding that the court did in Robbins, which was basically the prosecution didn't even demonstrate, it just contended that after 15 years, I'm sorry, this is in Valdez, the memories of the victims would have been dimmed and they would have been hard to find. It was the same kind of finding that the court made in this case, except in this case, it was even a longer period of time than it was in Valdez. And
I ask a question, counsel.
Sure.
On the question of diligence, isn't there a problem when a person is saying, gee, I was mentally impaired at the time? If a person is mentally impaired, are they able to act with diligence? How do we resolve that issue?
Well, I would say that we have enough evidence in this record that this defendant was not mentally impaired. Whether or not the actual recording of his confession is no longer available, we have the record of the trial or the motions hearings that goes through exactly what he said when he spoke to the police and everything he went through in his confession of lighting this apartment on fire. And we also have his statements on the record of waiving his right to testify and everything else. I mean, I don't think there's anything in the record of what we have that demonstrates any sort of mental impairment. Let alone what, did he miraculously recover from this impairment 20 years later, and then now he can assert it? I mean, there's just nothing there. I do think, again, I think it's important that it would be virtually impossible if you're going to make a laches finding, which the Supreme Court has said, you can make that argument. You don't have to show detrimental reliance because, again, it would be nearly impossible to do so in a criminal case. I think that the defendant's examples in the reply brief demonstrate that, you know, party A relying on something and moving somewhere. It all has to do with reliance on what, you know, someone has allegedly done. And here you just have nothing for years, but you do have this severe prejudice on the part of the people. And I know that the trial court made a finding that there was prejudice despite the whole record issue. And there was one thing I wanted to address with respect to that. While the prosecution did authorize release of the evidence, and I think it's important to note that it did not authorize destruction, release, there is an affidavit in the record by one of the investigators at page 635 of the trial court record, who indicated that although that authorization for release was signed in 1993, the only evidence we have is that it wouldn't have occurred until 1995 or 1996. That's what he says. This is the best of his recollection. So we're still well past 3 years. And there was also no discussion.
Can I just stop you there for a
sure.
minute? Other than that affidavit, is there any evidence anywhere in the record telling us when, in fact, evidence was destroyed, if at all, for
right.
that matter?
No. I think his affidavit does say, to the best of my recollection, the evidence from this case was transported to the Larimer County landfill, and there was a supervised burial. But he does say it would have occurred in the 95 to 96 time frame. So you're well after 3 years. I realize, again, for a Class 1 felony, you have forever, technically, unless you can satisfy all three prongs of the test for latches. And again, that raises a good point, because I haven't found anywhere that there is a constitutional right to indefinite preservation of evidence. I don't think there is any argument made that several years after all direct appeals are done is an unreasonable time to authorize release of evidence. I mean, given the number of courts and trials and everything else that we have, you'd be bogged down if you weren't eventually letting this stuff go. Unless this court has any other questions, that's all I have. I'd ask that you affirm the trial court's order.
The initial notice of it's okay to release the evidence, whatever it was called.
Yes.
Was that sent to defense counsel, a copy?
Yes.
Do we know if a copy was sent to the defendant?
We don't.
And I don't think there's been an allegation about that either way.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Allen.
I'm going to have to talk fast to get everything in 30 seconds. But first of all, regarding the letter being sent to defense counsel, remember, under Criminal Rule 44, defense counsel is automatically withdrawn after sentencing. So sending him that letter years and years after the fact is not effective to put the defendant on notice, because that lawyer is no longer representing him pursuant to the criminal rules. And the Attorney General argued that it's nearly impossible to show detrimental reliance in a criminal case. That's exactly correct, and as it should be, because the defendant has the statutory right to raise his constitutional deficiencies in his trial, and he should be allowed to exercise that constitutional right unless he does something affirmatively to waive it. So for the people to have detrimental reliance, they would have to have something affirmative from the defendant saying, I'm not filing a Rule 35C motion, or I'm releasing my post-conviction rights, and, you know, something more than just delay. And I see I'm out of time.
Thank you, Ms. Brennan. Thank you to both counsel for your very helpful arguments. Case will stand submitted. The division will issue an opinion in due course.